Then let's do it. Quiz. You're right. This takes us to a word 100. So we're starting with 81 up here. Ace erkamai. I go in, come in, enter. And notice that's one of those compound words we've been talking about. But so it has a preposition on the front, ace, and then erkamai is a, you've already learned erkamai. I don't remember which number it is, but erkamai means to come or go. Ace means into, right? So to ace erkamai, to come in, go in. Namas, law, right? Well, just to connect this to Grant, you've been listening to the Deuteronomy, right? Deutero, namas is Greek. Deutero, two, namas, law. So second law. Yeah, Deuteronomy, the name Deuteronomy comes from the Greek Septuagint. Yeah, see? Yeah, I'm just connecting dots for you. Yeah. Para. Now, again, this is one of those prepositions. It can mean different things depending on the case that it's connected with. So with the genitive, it means from, dative, beside, or in the presence of. With accusative, alongside of, or even more than. All right, so those prepositions are, man, they're brutal on a vocab test because you're never quite sure which, you know. Yeah. But they're...
Alongside of, would that be also with? Because that was on the... Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But with is, yeah. I mean, para can be with. Mm-hmm. But then you also have like soon, which is another Greek word that's typically translated with, together with. Let me think. There's another one too. Those are the two main ones. There's another one I'm missing. But it's, yeah. And it really is subtleties. So you have to get into BDAG to kind of see the difference. Because some of them have more of a, I'm trying to remember which one's which. I think soon is the one that has a little bit more personal aspect to it. So in other words, if it's two people being together, then it would be soon. It's more a relational word.
Okay.
Whereas para can be more of like a spatial word. And soon can be that way too. Yeah, so like two things in relationship to each other versus being together with someone. So like those compound words like in Ephesians 2 where it says that we have been, you know, raised together with Christ, it's the word soon. But it's typically actually attached to, it's a compound word. It's like, let's just go there real quick since we're talking about it. And tonight we have, maybe, we'll see. A little less lecture, because we're just going to confine ourselves to contract verbs and liquid verbs. But I was going to say, so like verse 5, Ephesians 2, 5. So kai ontas, so right here is what I was after. Made alive together with. So notice it's soon on the front. And then... it's the verb form of Zoe, right? But Zoe would be the noun, life. But this is more the verb form. So made alive together with. And then verse 6, soon a geren is raised up together with. And then this is the made to sit together. Soon a kathisen.
Those are all personal.
Yeah. But then also, I'm pretty sure, so like the same thing in like Colossians 3, verse 4, here we go. So when Christ, who is our life, appears, we'll appear, with him in glory, is in Greek, soon, auto, and then this is the, actually, remember, you can parse this one. Yeah, the funny, rothesis the. Parse that quick based off of the last couple of weeks. Exactly. Good. Good catch. So you see the theta, eta, sigma in there? So the theta, eta, sigma is... Anyways, there's somewhere in here I can actually write on this if I knew how to do it. No, I don't know how to do it. But Anyways, so that is a future passive, second person plural, because the este ending is the second person plural, if you remember that. But notice, with him we will be made to appear in glory. But the with him is, again, it's more of a personal, you know, person-to-person relational connection. So, anyways. Number 84, grapho. I write. So this is, again, where we get the English word graphite, something you write with. Or photograph. Photograph is actually two Greek words, photos, light, and then write. Exactly. You write with light. Photograph is something written by light, which is super cool, right? When you look at the lens and how it was all, you know, captured. And what's it made out of again? The film? That, like, and then it, the lens just opens quick and it captures the light and it makes an impression on the film, which I can't remember how they make what the film is made out of, but the filament, I don't remember what it's called, but anyways, but it receives the impression from the light, and it's just that real quick, you know, snapshot that impresses it upon the film. And so photograph is such a cool word. It's one of my favorite words.
Which is the opposite of x-ray, because x-ray, it captures everything that stops the light.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because that's why bone chills, because it's more dense.
It's dense.
It stops the light, and so it leaves that impression. Whatever stops the light leaves
yeah.
the impression.
Well, and then isn't x-ray, like, I mean, because it's rays that's being shot out from the machine, right?
Yeah.
So, like, even the name means x-ray, like rays going out, bombarding.
The denser the object, the more it stops.
Yep.
And the more light, the more rays that are stopped, the more clear the object.
See, there we go.
So
it's in the name.
It's like the negative of a photograph.
There you go. Oh, very nice. The negative of a photograph. That's cool. It's the opposite of. Right. Ha! That's cool. Okay, number 85. You guys know this one. Cosmos. Right? Pretty common word. World, universe. Still use it in the English language. Kathos. As, just as, even as, since. Men, on the one hand, to be sure, indeed. So typically, not always, but men is often associated with de. Remember that? The men de construction. So men is on the one hand, de is on the other. But men can sometimes be alone, just stand alone, which means it's normally translated indeed, or it's intensive. But if it's coupled with de, then it's on the one hand and then on the other. And when you do that, men de pair, the de is more emphatic. In other words, it's telling you, you know, on the one hand, but on the other, and the counterpoint that is more emphatic. That's the one more focused on by the writer, normally. Number 88, care or keros, hand. Oh, why am I doing all this work? You guys should learn, be practicing your pronunciation. Okay, Grant, can you read for us number 89? Or the next one after care?
Oh, man.
Sorry, I made you start. Good. Yep, so, but it's a rough breather, so it's kind of like a sound, so heurisko. Yeah, so it's actually connected to that word eureka.
Eureka, that's what I said.
Yep.
I was like, eureka.
It actually is connected to the word eureka.
It's his word to memorize.
Yep.
When you find it,
exactly. Eureka, right? So eureka means I found it, and that's what heurisko. It actually comes from heurisko. Yep.
That was a total guess. I didn't.
Well done. See, it's funny. When people start studying vocab, you actually know more than you think you do, because there is a lot of crossover into English. But so this one, you should know this one. Angelos. Angel, right? It's just translated or transliterated. We just transliterate it into angel. Number 91.
Akalos.
Oh, well done. Akalos. You just jumped in there. Mm-hmm. I didn't even call upon you. Well done. Way to pronounce it.
That
well done. Okay, so that means...
I was going ahead trying to see where my place in line was going to come, but you took his...
Oh, see, now I got to come back to you, Sean. Oh, I know, sorry. I took the easy one, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Okay, so number 92, can you do that one for us? Sorry, I should make that way bigger. Whoops.
Hamartia.
Yep, hamartia. Hamartia. So in theology, we call it hamartiology, which is the study of sin. Yep, and it's right from Greek. Hamartia is sin or sinfulness. Okay, can you do number 93, Lisa?
Ergon.
Say it again.
Ergon.
Ergon, excellent. Work or deed. So, it's actually a different form of that, but it's our word energy comes from that. Energy. And it's, I think it's from Greek, but I might go through Latin to get our English. I'd have to double check that, but actually is connected to the Greek word for work or deed or energy, meaning the power to do something. On is just, again, untranslatable particle of contingency. So typically this is when, like, on you add, remember when we were talking about pronouns and you have like hos or something that means who, which, or where, and then you have on connected to it, so it turns who into whoever. Or it turns where into wherever. But it's sometimes when it's attached to a word, it'll actually change the word. Sometimes it's unattached and it's just the word on, and you don't normally translate it. But it has the idea of contingency. Okay, Grant, back to you. Number 95.
Oh, doxa.
Doxa. Excellent. Which is, did you get that one? Glory. So this is where, like, doxology.
I just realized that when I saw the definition, I was pronouncing the, is that a zeta?
It's a xi.
Or a xi. That's, I was thinking.
Yeah. So the zeta, oh, where was it? I thought we had a zeta up here.
You think I'd have my letters memorized at this point?
No, it's okay. It's, those are a couple of the tougher ones that don't, they're not as frequent.
Yeah,
where is the zeta? I'm trying to find a word that has a zeta in it to show you the difference. What's that? Oh, right there. So seek, see that one? Number 144. That's zeteo, and that's a zeta on the front. Do you see the zeta? And then the xi, which is more of our X sound, that's the doxa over here. Okay. Okay, Sean, back to you. Good. And that one's not too hard to remember either, right? Because it's connected to the word politics. So polis is actually a Greek word for city or town. Politics is that which pertains to the city.
Where
so
the word metropolis comes from?
Yep, metropolis, same thing. Metro, polis, big city, and surrounding areas. Yeah. So yeah, polis is... That one comes right along, or right into English. That one's not too hard.
Does it come from that too?
I think it does, actually. It's a related word,
yeah.
Because it's actually, there's a different word, it's probably in here, that has to do with like a civil servant,
mm-hmm.
And it's connected to that. Yeah. Boy. I wonder if it's in here. Nope, civil's not it. I have to look that one up. But it is connected to polis. I can't remember. It's pol something. Politia or something. It's like a basically a city official is what it means. So I'd have to double check that. But I would suspect police comes straight from there as well. Because in other words, it's probably root connected. In other words, city paid employees that work for the city kind of thing. Yep, exactly. Okay, whose turn is it? Okay, number 97 there, Corey.
Basileia.
What? Dude, you rocked that. Well done. Your pronunciation has just come so far. Well done. Basileia.
It's amazing what a little study.
Yeah, right. It's like, it's amazing how that works. Well done.
I hate to out myself.
Yeah, well done, sir.
You're not out of yourself.
Yeah, don't worry about it. You are in good company here, okay? Good. Basileia, kingdom or kingship. Excellent. Okay, and then Elisa, number 98. Good, and that one's not too hard either. We still have that in English. Ethnicity. Ethnicity is the nation that you come from, or the descent. So it's nation or Gentiles is normally when it's in the plural, then it means Gentiles. So because it's nations. But that was an Israeli way of just saying anyone non-Jewish,
yeah.
Right? Because you have like Jewish or Hebrew or Judea, you know, and then you have...
Everybody else.
Yep, everybody else. So...
The nations or Gentiles.
Exactly.
They didn't care to put them in groups, they were just all...
Exactly. But when you ask, when it shows up in the singular, like what nation do you come from? Now that would be the... I'd have to double check this, but I bet it's that way in the Septuagint. Like in Jonah, when they ask him, you know, where are you from? What nation are you? It would be ethnos, singular. But... All right, we back to Grant, number 99.
Tate.
Good, tate. Well done. Then or at that time. And then, you can't get that one wrong. Look at that, Sean. Pronounce number 100 for us.
That first letter.
So, yeah, capital P. Okay. Yeah. So it's pi, but it's the RP sound.
Pauras.
Paulos. Yep, so it's Paul, the Apostle Paul.
Now,
Paulos.
At least there's a vernacular similarity to city of Paul.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar sounding.
Yeah, I mean,
it's different letters, though.
Yeah.
Because now I need to double check that. But Paul actually means little, I think. Yeah. So I don't think it's etymologically connected to polis. Yeah. Because polis is like a pi omicron, where this is a alpha upsilon. Yeah. But it does, yeah, you're right. It has a similar sound because it starts with a P, has an L in there, and a sigma at the end. But
Paul means little, did Saul mean big?
So Saul means asked for.
Asked for.
Yeah. In Hebrew. Because it's the word... Shaul. So it means to be asked for or requested, which is awesome, right? Because they asked for a king.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I love that connection. Yeah. But it's actually similar. It's a little different word, but like Samuel is, you know, Shmuel is actually similar, you know, idea. Well, no, that one means I was heard. I was heard because it's actually connected to Shema, I think. Mm-hmm. Shmuel. So, like, in other words, Hannah prayed, and she was heard. Her prayer was heard, so she named him Shmuel.
Has anybody written a study or a book about just analyzing all the names in the Bible?
Yeah.
The meanings and the connection to
what? Mm-hmm.
I'm
yeah.
Based on that.
There's, yeah. I have looked. There's a couple books out there. A bunch of them come in, like, I don't know, the first one that jumped into my mind was Dake's Annotated Reference Bible, which... I bet he talks about that a lot. I don't know if he compiled it into a full list, but there are several books out there. I can't think of one off the top of my head. That it's a cool concept. I love walking through Luke 1 and, you know, all the names in that first story, right? So like Zechariah means Yahweh remembers, and then Elizabeth is Elisheva, the God of the covenant, or my God is my God's covenant. So like the couple, right, is Zechariah and Elizabeth, have no children. And it's the idea is, you know, yeah, God remembers his covenant or his oath. God remembers his oath. And then he gives them Yohanan, which means the gift of the Lord. So it's, you know, it's so cool. You work your way through that. And then of course, Jesus, of course, you know, Yeshua, he'll save his people from their sins. It just goes on and on. Yeah. And there's a lot of significance.
So lost in modernity because, you know, we just come up with names because we like how they sound, they're popular. Whereas names
right.
used to have specific meanings.
Yeah.
There's a lot of thought put into naming something.
It is. And then a name change, like when they're midlife or something, yeah. and they change their name. Someone just asked me that about the difference between Simon and Peter. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about it at men's group.
Yeah.
But
is that a nickname, just so that they could? There was maybe a lot of Simons or a lot of Peters, and so they had
that. So, I mean, I think the way we've been taking it at men's group is Simon is just the Greek version of Simeon.
Mm-hmm.
So, like he, you know, as in the tribe of Simeon, a very Jewish name, but then. Peter, Petros, is the same as Cephas. Cephas is Aramaic. Petros is Greek. But they both mean rock or stone. And the idea seems to be that it was a nickname, but it was a name that Jesus gave him that he would be living up to.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah, foreshadowing what he would become.
You know, when you talk about changing names and like in the life of American Indians, you were given a child name. Like a nickname until you earned a nickname.
Yeah.
Something you did.
Something
a
accomplishment or whatever. Yep.
Then you got your adult name.
Yeah. Yeah, the Native American culture is fascinating in that regard. I mean, they got, you know, weird names to our ears, but it's like they, you know, but the concept of naming
yeah.
is powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah, they get that. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So,
a new name. That, yeah.
If he was called Rock because of the way he looked, like being a big guy or something, because he was a big fisherman. So,
it's really just conjecture.
Yeah.
I mean, it might have been related to that. But Jesus, it appears the very first time Jesus encounters him. So remember, Andrew, his brother, goes and fetches Peter and brings him to Jesus, John chapter 1. And first thing. Yeah, he says, like, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, or whatever. But then he says, but now you'll be known as Peter. And he gives him the name, like, and that was the first time Peter ever met Jesus. And so, like, what a weird encounter, right? I mean, you walk up and you're like, you just got renamed by a guy. Yeah, right. He's like, what is happening? What is happening? But I think it was... Yeah.
Or
yeah.
As you know, if you've ever been confirmed in the Catholic Church, you get me.
What?
I'm Michael.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I was going to ask. You told me that before.
You
yeah, what's your Catholic name? Michael. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. It's true. You also have something similar in the Mormon Church. Yeah, when you're inducted at some point. Yep, it's a secret name.
Your husband gets
in the temple ceremony, right?
The wife gets a new name that only the husband knows. Talk about a tool to keep someone in line, because that's the name he has to call you out of the grave with.
That's right. And his
so, like,
your resurrection.
Life, it's like, that's
right.
That
no, you're exactly right, because in Mormon theology, the woman's resurrection is dependent upon the husband.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he's given a secret name in the temple when they're married.
Yep.
To call her out of the grave.
Yep. And you wonder why Utah has more antidepressants than anyone else.
talk about an instrument.
Yeah, I was going to say, that actually makes a lot of sense.
You know, I won't call your name.
I'm not calling your name.
Yeah, that's a powerful idea. Okay, so any questions on the quiz before we move on to the lecture quick? Okay, so let's just jump into the lecture. So we're today going to talk about three types of verbs that basically we've kind of already talked about them as we've been working our way through the indicative verb chart. But mainly when I talk about contractions, you know, or, you know, when it amalgamates or, you know, two vowels or letters won't combine well and so they drop sometimes. So we're going to talk about three types of verbs that just this happens a lot. And so you're at least aware of them. The first one is a group of verbs just known as contract verbs. And these are verbs whose stem ends in one of these three vowels, an alpha, epsilon, or omicron. So an A-E-O. And the point is, almost all your verb endings are going to start with a vowel, or there's going to be a connector vowel, right, that we've talked about several times, the connector vowel being omicron or epsilon. And so when you have two vowels joined together, then it's typically going to amalgamate into something else. So contract verbs are very common, and they just, the stem ends in an alpha, epsilon, or an omicron. So these verb stems ending in vowel contract with the connecting vowels or the personal ending of the omega conjugation in the present and imperfect tenses, the vowel lengthens before the consonant indicator of the other tenses. That is, so like a sigma, recall, is just a consonant indicator or tense formant, it's sometimes called. So like the sigma is the giveaway for which tense? Actually, there's two possibilities. So the sigma is a tense indicator of the future tense or aorist, exactly. But the aorist is typically the sigma alpha, typically. And then it'll also have, recall, in the front of an aorist is a prefix, the prefixed epsilon. So that's how you know it's an aorist, is if it's got an epsilon on the front. But remember, an epsilon, if it's like a, I'll give you an example. Well, so like agapao in a minute. Agapao is the Greek word I love, right? From, you know, agape would be the noun form of that. So agapao, if you make that into an aorist, then you actually have an epsilon in the front, but the epsilon and the alpha amalgamate to an eta. And so agapao turns into, you know, with an eta on the front, that means there's a prefix. So don't forget that can happen. You know, that amalgamation can happen, you know, at the front of the stem if you add a prefix, or at the end of the stem when you add on your suffix, your, you know, verb endings. So the sigma can be, you know, the sign of the future tense, but the future would have a sigma and, remember, no prefix on the front for the future tense. But the aorist would have a prefix on the front and a sigma alpha as the tense indicator. Or, remember, there's a second way to form an aorist, second aorist, which is, you remember, it's... What's that? That's for a perfect. There you go, root spelling change. Good. So that's like the English example, go and went, right? Go is the present tense, went is the past tense. So when we do it in English, when we change tense, sometimes we just spell it different. We totally change the spelling of the word. And when the root is completely misspelled, or not misspelled, but change the spelling, then that's an indicator of an aorist tense. Or, just on this slide, the other tense formant or consonant indicator is a kappa, which the kappa is the giveaway for what? Good. Perfect. Active. Yeah, because the middle passive will not have a kappa. Yep, so it's perfect active. So just here's a list of your...
Perfect is reduplication.
Correct, there's reduplication in the front. Yeah, and then a kappa in connecting the stem to the... Normally a kappa alpha, but there's a kappa connecting the stem to the ending. Yeah, in the perfect active voice. But in the middle passive voice, the kappa doesn't appear.
But you still have the reduplication.
Correct. You still have reduplication on the front. Yep. Okay, so here are your more common contract verbs that appear in the New Testament. And there's a lot more than this. This is just the ones you're going to run into most frequently. Agapao, timao, poieo, kaleo, zeteo, plerao. So notice what makes a contract verb, recall, is, it would be right here, right? So it's, the stem ends with either an A-E-O, alpha, epsilon, omicron, all right? So, but what happens is when you, and you've already seen this chart, but what happens when you jam two vowels together, then it typically will transform into another vowel. So you don't necessarily have to memorize all these because that's a lot of brain power, but just to recognize that this happens and try to, again, memorize your vocab and realize the stems that end in one of those vowels will normally have contraction going on, and it's normally going to lengthen that vowel. So like an alpha epsilon is just going to actually stay in alpha. An alpha epsilon iota is going to go alpha with an iota subscript. And notice it's kind of interesting, but like when you have a, and you learn basic rules, but like when you have an alpha epsilon, the alpha is more powerful. So that typically takes over. But whenever you have an O class vowel, that always takes over. So if an alpha comes up against an omicron, it goes omega. So notice omega is just the lengthened form of omicron. A-O, A-O, right? So it's still considered an O class vowel. But notice the O is always more powerful. So like that's going to take over. And that pretty much holds sway all the way through. So notice here, well, you know, epsilon, epsilon is just going to go epsilon iota. So an e turns into an A. So it's like, remember, because that's a diphthong, epsilon iota. So it's spelled out epsilon iota, but it's actually pronounced kind of like an eta. Again, epsilon lengthened is going to go eta. But whenever you have an O, notice that's gonna become dominant. So that just, it may lengthen from, so like an epsilon omicron is gonna lengthen to an U. Epsilon U is gonna stay an U. Epsilon omega is gonna become omega. So the O class is like the most powerful. It typically plays, it wins out in the contraction. A class would kind of be, I guess, maybe second most powerful, and then E class is kind of the bottom of the barrel. It's the weakest vowel. In other words, it normally contracts out. But here again, notice if you have an O attached to pretty much anything, it's going to retain an O class. It'll lengthen to either an U, omicron, upsilon, oi. That's like if you have an iota in there, then you'll have the omicron iota. Or it'll just go omega. But the omega or the O class is typically the most powerful. So what that looks like, if you were to do a conjugation of a contract verb, remember contract verb means it's one who ends, the stem ends in alpha, epsilon, omicron. So it will contract, and it will contract every time, which gives you some weird-looking forms sometimes. Then here's a good example. So this is the present active indicative of ireo. Ireo. But notice ireo, the stem, ends with an epsilon. So notice, technically, it's ireo. But you're not going to have an epsilon and an omega stay there. So the epsilon drops and it becomes iro with that little circumflex over top the omega, because the circumflex shows you some sort of amalgamation has taken place. Does that make sense? So technically, the far left is technically what it should be, because you remember your endings, luo, luace, luae, so o, ace, a. So there's your ending, but it's not going to like those two epsilons next to each other, so it's going to drop one. And it just is going to be irace. Same thing here. Again, two epsilons, but it doesn't like two epsilons. It's not going to keep two epsilons, so it's going to drop one, and it's just going to have the A ending with the circumflex. And the circumflex showing you a vowel dropped out. Ireomen. Here, notice it doesn't like the e-a, so it lengthens to oo. I rumen. I re'ete. Again, two epsilons. No, doesn't like that. So it's going to lengthen to epsilon iota. I re'ete. That makes sense? And then same here, you have an epsilon plus an oo. That's too many vowels all next to each other. So it drops the epsilon, contracts, and it just keeps the oo. Does that make sense? So I'm just teaching you this, not that you have to memorize this chart, you know, and just recognize, generally speaking, O class is the strongest, then A, then epsilon. But just recognize whenever you see that circumflex up on top, okay, some sort of amalgamation has happened, and then just kind of work through your memory, your charts, and be like, okay, it's going to probably, you know, it's probably a contract verb. There's other reasons that that circumflex might be there. We'll talk about it when we get to liquid verbs here in a second. But it's showing you amalgamation has happened. And just realize that that's common in contract verbs. If the stem ends in basically a vowel, but those three primary vowels of omicron, epsilon, alpha. So let me give you another example. So does this make sense? The present indicative active of ireo. You see how that works? So another example of a contract verb is timao. So timao is... often you're going to see it as just timo, right? Because that alpha omega, again, doesn't like that. So the omega, more powerful, swallows up the alpha, and you have this circumflex on top, just showing you that amalgamation has happened. But that's still perfect active indicative. So tima ace, again, the... ace doesn't like this here. So it drops the epsilon iota, keeps the alpha, because remember alpha's stronger than epsilon. Again, kind of just think pecking order, right? Omega is like your big dog. Then you have alpha's the next one, epsilon's the weakest. And so in here, epsilon gives way to the alpha, but it retains that little iota subscript. So that it would turn into timas. And then tima. And then timomen. Notice the alpha omega here, again, which is stronger. The O class is always stronger, but it will typically lengthen from an A to an O. So it'll go omega. But then that circumflex shows you something's happened. So it's timomen. It just realized it's actually technically timaomen. But see how awkward that is to pronounce? Tim, amen. You know.
That's some tongue chalice.
Yeah, you're like, man, that's just terrible. And the Greeks realize that, so they're like, okay, we're just dropping that, and it turns into Tim Omen, because it's way easier to say. So that's why contract verbs are a thing. So same thing, Tim Aete just becomes Tim Ate with the circumflex on top, but the alpha wins over the epsilon, because epsilon's the weakest. And then same thing here. Tim ausi turns into tim osi, because the alpha is weaker than the O class, which is, in this case, is a diphthong. It's an U, omicron upsilon. But then with the alpha, it lengthens to the omega. All right, so again, don't hurt your brain by trying to memorize all the contract rules other than what I said, the simplest thing to remember: omicron's the strongest, alpha's next, epsilon's the weakest. And watch for the circumflex, because that circumflex over top is going to indicate some sort of amalgamation has happened, some sort of contraction has happened, there's been a vowel dropped out somewhere, and just don't realize, you know, realize, don't be thrown by that.
And
so
that's every time you see that.
Every time you see that in a contract verb. So there might be other reasons, which we'll talk about a couple others. But so when you see that circumflex, you're going to be kind of running your mind through a couple questions. Is it a contract verb, which often it is? Or it might be, second option, a liquid verb. So this is another, it's just a pronunciation thing, which means it changes spelling, which means it frustrates Greek students, okay? But you have your contract verbs, which is where the stem ends in a vowel, particularly, you know, omicron, epsilon, alpha. Or the stem ends in a lambda, mu, nu, or rho. These are called liquid verbs. And the way I remember this, lambda, nu, mu, nu, rho, is just the acronym Learning More Nonsense Rules. Okay? In other words, you have just another nonsense rule that you're like, what in the world is going on? But learning, that's your L. More, there's your M. Nonsense, there's your N. Rules, there's your rho or your R. So learning more nonsense rules, or the liquid verbs, is where a stem ends in one of these consonants. So verb stems ending in a liquid consonant cannot stand next to the sigma of the future or aorist tense indicators. Because remember, those sigma, it's a pronunciation thing. So it's tough to say ilts and put a lambda next to a sigma. It's a tongue twister. It's really hard. Same with an M, you know, MS, NS, RS. It doesn't like those sounds. The Greek language, the Greek ear, the Greek pronunciation did not like those sounds together. So if a stem ends in one of those consonants, it cannot stand next to the sigma, which is the tense indicator of either the future tense or the aorist tense. So compensations are made. In the future tense, the sigma is typically dropped, but an epsilon is added to the stem and the verb is conjugated like the epsilon contract verbs above, which is what we kind of already talked about, the back to that this contract slide. In other words, it's going to follow those rules of the epsilon contraction. So notice in the future tense, it drops the S. In the aorist tense, the sigma alpha, the sigma is dropped. And the short stem vowel preceding the liquid letter is often lengthened. So many liquid verbs also lengthen the stem to the present or in the present tense. So the point is, these verbs are also, they can look a little funky. They look like they're violate, you know, in other words, they're exceptions to the rules that we've kind of already learned in the indicative chart, because of those letters don't play nice together. The lambda mu nu rho does not like the sigma. And so as a result, there's compensation that is made. Typically the sigma is dropped, and like in the future tense, it adds an epsilon. In the aorist tense, the short stem vowel is lengthened. So let me just give you some examples. Well, this will be our main one. Is philo. So notice philo is technically phileo, but it doesn't like the e-o together. So notice just look for that circumflex up on top of the letter. It's showing you something dropped out. So it's going to change there. S is again, it's going to drop the epsilon, just keep the S contraction. Filet, drop the extra epsilon, it's the same thing going on. All right? So this is where sometimes it gets tricky, because a future tense looks like a present tense. Okay, because the normal sigma that would be indicating the future tense dropped because it's in front of one of these letters. Or it's right after, you know, one of these letters, that lambda, mu, nu, rho. So it looks kind of like a present tense, but with that circumflex, you're like, oh, that is a future. Did I lose you there?
A little bit.
Okay. So big rule is just look for that circumflex and know that there is some amalgamation that's taken place. Then you have to ask yourself, why is it amalgamating? Is it a contract verb? Because that's kind of option one. And so you're looking at the stem. And if the stem ends in a vowel, then you're like, okay, then it was a contract verb. And it's probably still a present tense. But if the stem ends in one of these consonants, lambda, nu, mu, nu, rho, then it could be a future tense because it dropped the S. Or it could be, you know, even a future is the one that you will most often see there, because if it's a aorist, you'll have this stem change or the prefix on the front. All right, so if you see it looks like a present tense, but it has that circumflex and the ending is after one of these consonants, then just realize that it could be a future tense. All right, so that's where, and when we'll see, I'm trying to think, because my goal is once I kind of work through, I'm going to give you one more, we're going to talk about me verbs for just a few minutes, then we're going to go back to John and just start translating again, but practicing our parsing every time we get to a verb. And I don't know, I can't remember in the beginning of John 1 if we come across one of these. We'll see. But where it's technically a future tense, though it looks like a present tense. But you know it's a future tense because it's going to have one of these consonants followed by a vowel with a circumflex over top of it. And it's because the sigma dropped out. The sigma that is indicating the future tense dropped out because it doesn't like these consonants. But the circumflex shows you that something dropped out. And so you just kind of have to run through the options and be like, well, is it a contract verb, present tense, or is it a liquid verb, future tense? Kind of make sense? It'll make more sense as we practice reading and we're staring at one of those verbs, and then we're like, oh, I got it. Okay? But I'm just introducing you to these exceptions of why these, because that looks kind of like a present. Well, it's actually a future. Right? Because it's the sigma dropped out.
So the sigma that dropped out, it's not showing, obviously, up there.
Right.
So I'm seeing where the epsilon dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
But where was the sigma? Do we have to go back to the stem to see where the sigma?
Yeah. Well, because the stem would not have the sigma.
Right.
The stem ends in one of these. But then in the future tense, so reread this sentence, in the future tense, the sigma drops, but an epsilon is added.
That's what I was missing.
Does that make sense?
So would you always infer if you see the epsilon in that case that the sigma has been exchanged for it?
But then the epsilon goes. Because
right, because it doesn't like the extra epsilon.
See, so this takes you,
right?
Assumes that you realize that the sigma turned to the epsilon is what's happening. That's the step I was missing.
Right. Yeah. So back to this slide, it's this sentence that you were missing.
Yeah.
Is in the future, it drops the sigma, but it adds an epsilon to the stem, and then it's conjugated like the normal epsilon contract verbs above. In other words, in the previous, we just finished talking about, you know, contract verbs. It looks like a contract verb, but it's actually a future tense with the sigma dropped, if it's following one of those consonants.
So the key is really one of those consonants.
Yep. Ends the stem.
With the circumflex.
Correct. With the circumflex. Circumflex comes after.
Okay.
Yep.
So what's the stem of phil? Isn't it phileo?
Yeah, so phil.
Just phil.
Phil would be the stem. Phileo would be the present active form.
Oh, okay. So
this is philo, is the future form.
Okay. So they're adding the sigma, but the sigma doesn't like
the lambda.
So then they have to add the epsilon, but then you're playing with contract verbs, so then the epsilon gets dropped. You know,
then it goes back, it just stays with the omega.
Okay.
Exactly. But then it puts the circumflex on top to show you amalgamation has happened. contracts. And I'm using the term amalgamation and contract, you know, like contraction, as basically, they're the same thing. I'm using those two terms as synonyms.
So when you see one of those consonants, you know the stem's ended.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, with those stems, right?
With those stems.
Yes, exactly. Because, and that's where you just have to memorize your vocab sheet, right? Because as you're trying to learn the stems, and again, any lexicon will help you out. If you're like stumping your toe and you're like, I can't figure this out. And that's where like that reader that you got's helpful, because the weird forms that as you're reading along, you're like, I don't understand it. It's probably in there.
Yeah.
It's going to help you with any of the weird forms.
Okay. But and our vocab sheet doesn't have the stems.
It's exactly.
The
so
most popular the use of the stem plus whatever tense.
So the lexical form, we call it lexical form, meaning the form you're going to look up in a lexicon, is always its form as it appears in the present active indicative.
So I do something.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh.
Exactly. So you actually have to look it up to find like the future tense. You probably can't find the future tense.
You have to look it up under the present active.
Exactly. You have to look it up under the present active form, and then in the paragraph it will list the other forms of the different tenses. Yeah. So when we say lexical form, it's present active indicative. It's like your base form. That's what you're memorizing when you memorize vocab. But so just realize that in there, the stem is in there, but you're seeing it in the present active form, which means you're often going to see an epsilon omega on the end. If it's an, you know, if it's not a me verb, which we're talking about next. Yeah, right, right. That's what Greek is. That's what Greek is. We take, yeah, we share, you know, give you something on the one hand and take it away with the next hand. So there's always exceptions to the rules, but it becomes familiar the more you use it. But okay, but liquid verbs, its own kind of weird, funky thing. So those are kind of connected, though. Contract verbs, liquid verbs are very similar. They're following the similar, you know, basic similar rules. It's just your contract verbs is a stem ending in a vowel. Your liquid verbs is a stem ending in a consonant, but specifically those four consonants that do not play well with the sigma. All right, so it really only matters in the future tense and the aorist tense because that's where the sigma pops up. Does that make sense? So that's where liquid verbs just, they end in one of those vowels, consonants, and so it's a little bit funky that way. But then the third verb type that we're going to talk about tonight, and then we'll just get to translating and practicing, is a class known as me verbs. Now, me verbs is a distinct and important class of verbs in Biblical Greek. They're highly irregular. In other words, they're frustrating because they don't follow very many rules. And it's not, you know, what you've learned in the indicative chart. It doesn't follow any of those rules because they're a special class of verbs known as me verbs. And the reason they're called me verbs is they end with me. In other words, in the lexical form, they end with a mu iota. So they're highly irregular, but represent some of the most frequently used verbs in the New Testament. So what's frustrating is they, you know, everything I taught you with the indicative chart, it doesn't follow that. But you're going to come across them quite a bit. So I'll explain the subpoints A, B, C to you in just a second. But let me just give you a short list of the most common verbs, which is the next slide. I will come back to this slide. But here's a short list of the most common me verbs in the New Testament. And you can see why you come across them so often. So diddo me is the verb I give, very frequent in the New Testament. Aphitta me, the word I forgive. Also very frequent in the New Testament. Tithemi, I put or place. Very frequent verb. And then histemi, I stand. So these are your top four me verbs that frequently appear in the New Testament, but they're not going to follow the same rules of the indicative verb chart that we've spent the last couple of weeks looking at. So what are the unique features of these verbs? Well, first, they add personal endings directly to the stem without a thematic vowel. So that's not a big deal, but it's different than what we've learned so far. Is they do not use a thematic vowel, a connecting vowel, to connect the stem to the ending. They just add the ending directly to the stem. Second, they often undergo stem changes in different tenses and moods, making them hard to recognize. In other words, the stem changes dramatically. The spelling changes. And yet that normally indicates an aorist tense, right? When the stem changes, we're thinking aorist. But if it's a me verb, it may be a different tense. Just because me verbs are funky. They just do not follow normal rules. They kind of are a class to their own. So they often undergo stem changes in different tenses and moods, making them hard to recognize. And then third, they typically have reduplication in the present tense, which is confusing because we've learned reduplication is a sign of the perfect. Yep, the perfect tense. So, but not with me verbs. With me verbs, the reduplication is often taking place in the present tense. So back to these, you know, four common verbs. Didomi is I give, but the did is actually reduplication. The root is actually the stem of didomi is delta omega, do. That's actually the stem, but this is your present active indicative form. Your stem is do, did o me, that's reduplication. But that's in the present tense, not the perfect tense. But that's what happens with me verbs. Me verbs have the present tense, not always, but it will often reduplicate. This technically down here is also reduplication. Tith Amy. So the root of tithemi is actually theta eta. That's the stem, the root. But the tith is reduplication. It's kind of weird. It's because you don't typically reduplicate a theta. It's not tithemi, right? But it takes the theta is like a th sound, if you will. So like a t is like a short theta. If I can put it that way. So that's technically reduplication. Tithemi. But that's a present tense, not a perfect tense. And so it's frustrating. But they're frequent. So these verbs show up a lot. So you'll start seeing them frequently enough that, you know, you kind of just figure on the top ones that you see regularly, you know, and you almost memorize them like another vocab word. You know, and don't exhaust yourself trying to figure out all the nuances of me verbs. Just recognize that if it's a me verb, it's going to look weird and it's not going to follow the rules that we've already learned. So example, so this is the present active indicative of didomi. So notice this side we already know, erase that. So this side we already know on the right hand side. That is our Luo chart. Luo, Luis, Lue, Luamen, Laeti, Luusi. All right, so that we've already memorized that. That's classic, and that's why they study Luo, is because it's a very simple verb that has no exceptions. It's like the most consistent verb. So that's typically the one they teach you the indicative chart with. But notice the same endings over here are going to be used with your me verbs, but notice instead of o, it's actually me in the first person singular. So didomi is I give, but then you have didos, didosin, didomen, didate, didasi, which is really weird. Yeah, because that should, you know, in what we've learned before with contract verbs, that should contract to an O, omega. But me verbs are just a little bit different, okay? Now, that's not too bad in the present tense, okay? You're like, all right, like ditto me, ditto's, ditto sin, ditto men, ditto Ted, ditto did a-o sin, is like, okay, that's, I think it's close enough you would recognize that, right, with your endings. The a-sin ending, the te ending is the same, the men is the first person plural. So you're like, okay, I can kind of recognize that. But then you go to aorist. And the aorist, that is technically ditto me, okay, but it's an aorist, so we know it's an aorist because notice that it retains the epsilon, right? There's your prefix, okay? But notice the did is gone. The reduplication's gone because that's in the present tense. And there's your root, do. But then this just drives me crazy because it has a kappa alpha, which is looks like, I mean, in my brain goes perfect active, but it's not with a me verb. So this is actually an aorist, first singular, edoka, second singular, edokas, third person, edoken.
Where's the cake? Where did they come from?
It's just weird with the me verbs. Yeah, it's like they go under pretty radical changes. And then here, notice you have your epsilon, your da, except here it's a O instead of an omega, an omicron instead of an omega. And then you have your familiar ending. So the men ending, you're like, okay, that's first person plural. But edomen is your first person plural aorist of didomi, aorist active indicative. So notice here, this top, just to explain it, this is kind of what you would sometimes, this is called a principal parts chart. So this is your present active indicative, ditto me. See if I can get all these right. This is your future active, doso. All right, so notice future active, and we know it's a future, mainly because I'm telling you. Because it doesn't even look like it. But there's your stem is do. Your tense formant is the sigma. All right, but no prefix. So that's a future tense. Edoka is your aorist. This is your perfect. Dedoka. So there's the reduplication. But in the present, it's de. In the perfect, it's de. You see that? So there's your kappa. So you're like, it does look like that. Right? But it has reduplication in the front and a kappa. If it just has the epsilon in the front and a kappa, that's aorist. That's not future. Or I'm sorry, perfect. So it's like, oh my goodness. So there's your that's your perfect active. This would be, oh, I need to double check that. That's either perfect middle passive because of the my ending. Or maybe pluperfect. I'd have to look that one up. And then this is your aorist passive right there. Edothane. But you see, that can get frustrating because you're like, wow, it doesn't, it makes up its own rules. But just realize that, again, these happen frequently enough in the New Testament, you will start recognizing them. But they're going to throw you for a loop at first. But just realize it's a me verb, and me verbs do not play nice. They do not play by the rules.
Recognizing them by memorization.
Yeah.
Not by applying certain rules to them.
Yeah, I mean, you could. Again, you can because it's consistent to its own system, but it's like learning a whole new system, and it's violating some of the key rules you just learned in the indicative chart. So because it has reduplication in the present tense and the perfect tense. But, and so you're like, wait a minute, you know, that's a new rule. Well, yeah, but it's for me verbs, not for your normal indicative O-class verbs. So, you know, and then it does retain the sigma, but the kappa alpha is not necessarily, like if it's a, you know, the kappa alpha is not solely an indicator of the perfect active like it is in the indicative chart, normal indicative chart. But it could be an aorist or a perfect active. The aorist will have an augment, you know, a prefix, and the perfect will have reduplication, but it's not de, it's de, you know, right here. So again, it does kind of follow its own rules, right? But it's different than what we've already learned with the indicative chart. So I just need to alert you to me verbs as kind of its own weird beast to learn how to tame, because it follows its own rules, basically. All right. So questions on that? I'm not expecting you to, you know, obviously master it in what we've been talking about it for 45 minutes, but just to be aware of it. And then we'll practice it as we're reading and translating. You're going to see them every once in a while because they do come up a lot. The me verbs are some of the most frequent in the New Testament. All right. Any thoughts on that before we go start translating? Did we already talked about Amy, didn't we? Because I have those verbs next, but I think we already talked about them. Just we'll review them real quick. But the Amy, remember, is one of the most frequent verbs in the New Testament. Amy just means I am. But notice the present tense of Amy is basically going to use your primary endings. Amy, so it's technically a me verb. But it's Amy, A, Estin, Esmen, Este, AC. So you're going to see those frequently. But, yeah, we did talk about this last week because we were reading John 1 and we looked at the imperfect. So there's your present tense of Amy. I am is the meaning of that, definition of that. But then there's your imperfect tense. Amen, ace, ain, amen, eta, ason. Now the reason you know it's imperfect is basically it's Amy, but you can't recognize it as Amy. It's totally spelled different. But why is it spelled different? Because in the imperfect tense, you have an epsilon in the front, right? So your epsilon and your A, your epsilon iota, when you put an epsilon in front of that, it contracts. That's why we get the eta. And then you just have your secondary endings. Main sa, ta, mathos, that, unta. But it's not, I gave you the wrong ones. It's your secondary endings. It's on your sheet. There we go. Thank you. Secondary middle passive endings is what they are. Yeah. But it looks a little different. Right? Because the saw isn't here. Right here. So it drops the omega. And then this looks way different. But it's again, it's a function of the me verb thing, the ame. But you'll just learn to recognize those. Is there's your present tense is going to have your epsilon in the front. Imperfect tense is going to have an eta on the front because of amalgamation. And then your future tense is going to have the sigma in the middle of it. Just because the sigma is the tense formant for the future. See that? So there's your sigma indicator. And it's going to have your primary middle passive endings. Mai sai tai mathos the untai. So it's SMI, SA, Estai, Esamitha, Esesta, Esantai. So I just alert you to those because, and notice you have that on your master sheet that I've been referring you to, is the conjugation of ame is on the noun review program side, but top right-hand corner, because you're going to run into ame all the time. I think it is the most frequently used verb. I should double check that, but I'm pretty sure it is. Because it's just the be verb. It's like our verb is, was, am. You know, it's just a very frequent verb in language. So present, imperfect, future. And then next week, we'll come back and start talking about the subjunctive. I won't show you the subjunctive tonight. We'll try to tackle the subjunctive mood next time. But those are the forms of ame that we've already covered. Present tense, imperfect tense, future tense. All right? But they're really, when you think about them, they're not that hard to identify. Present tense is just your lexical form, right? Ami. So it's going to have that epsilon iota on the front. But then when it starts with an eta, oh, that's imperfect tense, right? Because it amalgamated on the front with a prefix. And then your future tense is going to have the sigma in the middle. So it's like, okay, that's pretty easy to identify. Does that make sense? I know we talked about that, I think, last week when we were translating John 1. But I just want to review that with you quick. So now, any questions about that before we go to John chapter 1? Okay, let's go back to John 1 then, and let's start translating again. So in John 1, just a helpful review, we just talked about this, but John 1 is, get rid of these. Wait, I'll get rid of this one. Is this one too, like, this is kind of messy over here, isn't it? I've got all these extra notations on this side, so let's stick with this one over here. So we'll get rid of these. Okay. So this is your John chapter 1. We talked about this last week, but Grant, this is now like just repetitive for us. So you can fly through this. John 1:1. Go ahead and read it in Greek and translate it for us. You can read either off yours or off the screen.
Okay. N-R-K, ein-ha-logos, kai-ha-logos, ein-pros, tan-theon, kai-theos, ein-ha-logos.
Well done. Okay, translate.
See, N is in.
Good.
R-K is beginning.
Mm-hmm. It's actually where we get the word archaeology. Archaeology is the study of the beginning, the study of ancient things.
Logos is word, I forget, ein and ha.
So ha is your definite article, the word. And then ein is what we just looked at. That's the imperfect form, imperfect active indicative of Amy. So it's right here, third person. Yeah, can you see my screen? There we go.
Okay.
So ein, right there. So it's translated was. Was. Does that make sense? So it's past tense. It's not I am as present tense. That you'd translate a me as I am or a estin as is or am. But the imperfect tense ein is was. All right. Okay, good. So in the beginning was the word.
Logos in the word. Ein pros was torbs tan theon. Theon is God.
Good. Just in what case? Because it changes case. You have tan theon and then kai theos.
Right.
They're both God, but why are they spelled different? Remember the case endings? So the theos is nominative. Theon is accusative. Accusative meaning it's the direct object of the sentence. Does that make sense?
No.
Good. So the word was with God or to or toward God. And final phrase, kai theos, ein hologas.
And God was the word, or the word was God.
Good. So why do we translate it the word was God instead of God was the word? You remember that?
Because
excellent. Good. The article indicates the subject of the sentence. Good. Because they're both in the nominative case, but the subject is indicated by the article, and theos would be your, what would that be, predicate nominative. So it's in English we'd call it predicate nominative, but meaning it's a noun that is equal to the subject, but it's in the predicate. So it's like two things that are equal. The word was God. The word is God. There, it's basically the word ein there, imperfect active indicative of a me, is a, it's basically an equal sign. the word equals God. The word is God. Okay, excellent. Nailed it. Well done. Okay, Sean, verse 2. Can you read verse 2 for us? Read it in Greek and then translate. Okay, close. He, it does look like personal pronoun, but it's technically the demonstrative pronoun. So it can be he or this one. Technically, do you remember the difference between the demonstrative pronoun is this or that, this being the near one, that being the far demonstrative pronoun, and the personal pronoun is he or she. But to be fair, sometimes the demonstrative is translated like a personal pronoun, but I just want to make sure you recognize the difference. So houtas is the this one or he.
Pain is was.
Good.
Was him.
Arche, so archaeology, beginning, was in the beginning, or in beginning.
Two.
Good. Yep. Two, toward, with, any of those. And then ton theon. Ton, remember that? That's just an article. So it's the word the. But it's the accusative form of it. So that's where it's a little funky. Ha, up here, is the nominative form. But then ton is the accusative. So it's the article, even though it has a T on the front. It looks a little funky, but... So then ton, and then remember that word, the on is?
God.
Good. God just in the accusative. So just like up here in verse 1, ton, the on versus the os. The os is in the nominative, the on is the accusative. Good. So this one, or he, was in the beginning with God. Excellent. Okay, Corey, you want to take a stab at verse 3? Autu. Yeah, that upsilon, it looks... Oh, it's an upsilon. It looks kind of like a nu, but it's an upsilon.
Okay, this one. Elento?
Agenita. So...
Again,
yeah, so the g... Yeah, so the gamma and the lambda look similar. Yeah, they're just... Okay. Lambda points up, okay. Gamma points down. Yep. Choris.
Say it again.
Choris.
Oh, I put the cha. That's co.
Yeah, so when they transliterate it in transliteration, you know, like charts, okay. They'll often put a ch to, you know, but it's still more of like a hard k sound. But they distinguish it as a CH from the kappa. Because
okay.
Does that make sense? Yeah. So in English transliterations, they'll do that. But it's the pronunciation is more like a it's more like a hard K sound still. But it's almost like a, I don't know, like a rough breather to it.
It's like a character.
What's that?
It's like the CH in character.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like the CH in character. That's a good way of putting it. So it's still a K sound. It's not the CH sound. Like in English, but so co because it's omega and then rho iota sigma, so choris.
Choris.
Mm-hmm.
Anta.
Autu.
Autu.
There you go.
Autu.
I know, those upsilons and nus, which, by the way, I know we're just reading it, but imagine if you were copying this. This is one of the most common mistakes a copyist makes, is the nu versus an upsilon, because it's just a stroke of the pen, but, right, it's easy to mix those up, especially if you're reading a document that's a little fudged, you know, a little hazy. You can misread that really easily. Good, egg.
Egg.
Ooh, almost, agenita.
Agenita.
Well done, agenita.
Not well done, you had to do it for me.
Well, you were so close, really.
Well, and I should have had it down because I just read it 3 words previous.
Yeah, it's okay, that's why we're practicing.
Okay, now this one, this is... Ode?
Close, yeah. Ude.
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 Because once again, the epsilon.
Yep.
N.
Good. There's a rough breather there, so it's hen.
Hen.
Hen, yep. And then...
Ah.
Another rough breather, so it's ha.
Oh, ha. Hen, ha. Once again.
Yeah, right? This is the third time you've seen that same verb. I'm so sorry. I didn't write this. I'm just saying.
But this one is changing a little bit.
Yes. Okay, good. Good catch. Good eye. Let's talk about that. So how would you say that last word? I heard somebody muttering it. Grant, were you muttering it? How would you say it? Good. Yeah. Geganen. Geganen. Okay, so let's talk about that real quick. Geganen.
Okay.
So let's talk about that real quick. That same verb shows up 3 times in the same verse. The first 2 times is the same form. The 3rd time is a different form. And do you remember? We talked about this last week. Agenita. Parse that for me. Agenita. It's from ginamai. I'll give you that. Ginamai. But then...
Third person singular pairs, middle
passive. Yes. Good. Excellent. So it's third person singular.
Look at the brain on her.
Well done. Yeah, she has been laboring in John 1. Well done. Well done. Your labor is paying off. Okay, so that's an aorist. How do we know it's an aorist?
Epsilon.
Good. Good. So there's a epsilon in the front.
Mm-hmm. I was right.
And then, but an epsilon can be an aorist or an imperfect. So why do we know it's an aorist instead of an imperfect? And this, you have to think back to your vocab chart. But ginamai, how do you spell ginamai? Actually, here, I got my floater. I don't know if you can really see this. Well, go ahead.
Does it have a liquid ending with a...
No, no, but it has an iota in the lexical form. So here, it's an epsilon, gen, instead of gin. So there's a stem change. A spelling change in the stem, which is aorist. Good. So that's an aorist middle because of the ending. Indicative third person singular. Good. And so that shows up both times, agenita here and agenita down here in verse 3. But then this is the same verb, geganin. But why does it change form? What now parse geganin? What do you see?
Reduplication.
Good. So you have reduplication, which means it's going to be a
perfect active.
Perfect, yep. A perfect, either middle active or middle passive. Here, it's active, though it doesn't have a kappa alpha.
Which really messed me up for a while.
Yes. So you're like, oh man, because you're looking for the kappa.
Yeah.
Which does show up in many verbs, but not this one. So how do we know if it's active or middle passive? It's the ending. Recall? Because the ending, back to your endings, if it's middle passive, it's going to be maisai tai, mithasta untai. But this is the giganen, so it's actually your primary active ending. All right, good. So, did we have you translate that, verse 3?
No.
Panta di autu agenita kai koris autu agenita uda hencha geganen. How would you translate that? Ish, give a stab. Good. All. And this is in the neuter plural. So we would translate it not all people, but all things. Yep.
Through.
Good.
Him.
Good.
And this is where these mix up, right? Because twice it came, comes out as came.
Mm-hmm. All things through him became or came into existence. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And so Kai and then Koris. Do you remember what Koris means?
Without.
Yep. Without him or apart from. It can be apart from.
Apart from him. And then came to again.
Good. Became and then Uda Chen. Because Uda can be no, not, nothing.
Okay.
And then hen is one. So it's technically
not
one thing.
Not one thing.
Yeah, that's probably the most literal way to translate it.
Not one thing. Okay.
Yeah, so apart from him became not one thing.
Not one thing. That.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the same verb that is changed into
the perfect form.
Came to being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's normally translated was made.
Was made.
Yeah. So apart from him, became or came into being not one thing. Which was made, or which had
so
been made.
Came into being.
Right.
Versus came into being.
Yeah, either way. Yeah, came to be. Except to be is normally how you translate an infinitive, which we haven't studied yet.
Right.
But this is typically translated like not, so and apart from him, not one thing came into existence, or came into existence, not one thing, which has been made. Because the perfect tense is the idea of a past action, but it has present consequence.
Which,
right?
Theologically, this has big significance when confronting Mormonism, because Jesus is Lucifer's brother. But this verse says all things were made by him.
That's right.
Nothing existed before.
Exactly. Exactly.
So he is
the creator.
Yes.
Uncreated creator. And remember, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, but you remember the difference between ain, which is the aimee verb, and aginata, ginamai. Ain is just a stative verb. So in the beginning, the word was. He just existed in the very beginning. But ginamai, or aginata, is the aorist form.
Could that be said as, in the beginning, he already was?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because if in the beginning, kind of, how am I trying to put this? Signifies that in the beginning, God, but in the beginning, God already was.
Mm-hmm. Which I wonder, now that you mention that, if that's why it's in the imperfect tense. In other words, in the beginning, the word already was.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So, like, technically, there was a beginning, right?
But God wasn't.
But he was, is a past tense. Exactly. So he already existed prior to the beginning. Yeah.
Okay.
Boy, that's a cool thought, isn't it? Imperfect tense there. I like it. Well done, you theologian, you. Well done. Okay, verse 4. Elisa, go ahead.
In aho, zoe, ein, kai, e, zoe, ein, ta, phos, phos, ton, anthropon.
Anthropon, good. Okay, translate.
So, in him, life was, and the life was the light for man, the man of man.
Mm-hmm. The light of men. Yeah, because it's just a genitive plural of men. But we then would have to debate if we wanted to, you know, get into the weeds of what is the genitive use there. Is it, you know, what is that? Because remember, the genitive case, a genitive construction can communicate a lot of different ideas. It's almost a catch-all category. But the life was the light of men. Like, in what way was the light related to men? Because some would say a genitive, I mean, not here, but a genitive can be a genitive of source. Mm-hmm. In other words, the light from men. Yeah, but I don't think in this context. It could be a genitive of recipient. In other words, they're benefiting that, right? They're benefiting from the light of men. In other words, they're receiving the light, which I think is better in this context. Could be a genitive of, here, let me go back to my slides way back. Do you remember when we were talking about this?
Is that up here?
There we go. Let me go back to, there we go, right there, genitive uses. And this is not exhaustive. This is just a representative of different ways the genitive can be translated. Well, the different types of relationships that the genitive can communicate. And this is just some of your more common ones, but...
Yeah, I remember when we were going over the love of Christ.
Yep, exactly. So it can be possessive. In other words, the light of men. In other words, men's light. And that wouldn't be bad in this context. In other words, you know, back to our... In him was life, so that is in this one who created all things, who's always existed, the uncreated creator. In him was life, which is powerful, right? That we talk about, I talk about it often, but life being that self-sustaining attribute, which I was just translating 1 Timothy yesterday, and 1 Timothy 6 describes God as the one who gives life to all things. And I was like, oh, right there. I mean, it just is a great verse, but it's like connects back to Genesis. This idea that he has self-sustaining life. In him was life. Life is an inherent attribute of God. He's self-existent. And
life and light are connected.
Right. And the life was the light of men. So in what way, what is the life, and how is it the light of men? How are men, you know, connected to the light?
Right? So his life is the light that sparks other life. Which is why you would get light. So that...
Okay. I like that.
In his image, we would have that
mm-hmm.
spark.
Yep. No, I like that. I like that. And I think... Okay. I think I'd like that idea. I think in this context, only because verse 5 is going to keep expanding on it a little bit. I don't know if I'd quite... In other words, I'm not sure that's what's primarily in view. But let's just think about it. So verse 5, I'll do verse 5. Kai ta phos and the light en te skotia in the darkness phine shines. The light in the darkness shines. Kai, he, and the darkness, skotia, it, utas, neuter, it, u, no or not, does not, and this is its own debate, is katalaben. What's the best way to translate that?
Overcome.
Yes, so it's, and notice in the New King James, yeah, it gives you, it translates it comprehend, but then it footnotes it as it also can be translated overcome. Both of those possible translations. So if you look it up in a lexicon, katalaben, parse it real quick, katalaben. What do you see? Do you know offhand? Do you know where it comes from? I don't know if you memorized this word. It's katalambano is the lexical form. So this is actually, katalaben is an aorist, and we know that mainly because of the stem change. So do you see my floater? Can you see down here? So this is the lexical form right here, katalambano. So notice it drops the lambda. Which is the primary evidence that it's a, you know, stem change. So it's an aorist. But then notice, where is the augment on that? Do you remember? We talked about this like 3 weeks ago. Because it's not on the front. It's in between. Because kata lambano is a compound word. Do you remember that? Kata lambano. So notice... So do you see it goes from kata to kate? Do you see that?
Yeah.
So that's your augment, is it hides the augment in between the two words of a compound word. Remember us talking about that? So that's where that sometimes throws people off, but that is an aorist. And it can mean, if you look it up, it can mean to overcome or to comprehend.
So it's almost like, oh, the light was the goodness of God, and that goodness couldn't be comprehended by the darkness.
That's one way to take it. The other way to take it is that the light shined in the darkness. So in other words, so if we're following it all the way from verse 1, right, it's talking about this word, the Logos, that was uncreated, but the creator of all, and in him... So it's still talking about that person, at beginning of verse 4, in him was life. So he contained self-existent life, and the life was the light of men. So I would take it probably as it's still talking about him, you know, the word, who contains inherent life. He is the self-existent creator God. But when he comes to earth, he is shining, right? He is the light to men, for men, on behalf of men, or for the benefit of men.
In darkness because of sin.
That's
so
verse 5.
The light that he brings is the light of life.
Exactly.
From the darkness they were in.
Right. So that's verse 5. The light in the darkness shines. I think that is Jesus coming to earth, walking the earth, living a perfect life. He is shining in a dark place. He is perfect.
To the darkness almost.
Exactly. In opposition to the darkness. And the darkness did not understand it, which is true. They misunderstood him, crucified him, denied him, all of that. But you can also translate it the other way. The darkness did not overcome him, which is also true.
So technically, they would have understood exactly who he was, but they didn't overcome him. He overcame them.
Exactly. And think about it. You can take that several different ways too. The darkness did not overcome him. Meaning, first, moral perfection, right? He maintained perfect light and life, and he never was tarnished by sin.
Tempted without sin.
Exactly. Tempted in all points, yet without sin. But you can also take it another way. They did overcome him in the sense of crucifying him.
Physically.
But then he rose from the grave, right? So, like, they couldn't conquer him.
That didn't even overcome him,
really. Exactly.
Temporary.
Exactly. And really, both of those, this is a classic word study. In fact, when I have a sick day or when I'm gone and John fills in for me, he's got a little, he's going to teach you through the process of doing a Greek word study. And this is, maybe this one I'll suggest to him or something. This is a classic word study, is katalaben here in verse 5, is how, what is the best way to translate it? And I'm curious, so back to here, if we hit our comparison in verse 5.
Don't some translations translate it, grasp or grab it?
Yeah, so notice, let's see. Let me add a couple extra. Let's do the NIV, Young's Literal, L-N-I-R-V. Why not? Okay, so where am I? Verse 5. So notice, and the light shined in the darkness and did not comprehend it. And comprehend it. That's King James, New King James. Did not overcome it, ESV. Oh, NASB went with comprehend. Net went with has not mastered it. So it's the idea of overcoming or beating, defeating, mastering. NIV went with overcome. Oh, Young's Literal went with the comprehend idea. Did not perceive it. That's interesting. And then, what? The NIV says don't overcome. And then the NIRV, which is their reader version, switched their interpretation of that. They're like, no, we were right the first time. No, that's funny. I never noticed that before. But
Legacy.
What? Yeah. What does Legacy say?
Did not overtake.
Okay, so they go with the, which is more
opposite of,
which is opposite than NASB. See, they switched their mind. They changed their mind on that. That is interesting. I should have.
Those two are connected, right?
Yeah, those two are connected. I should have done the Legacy LSB. Right there, we go. And I'll add that one in there. There we go. There's the LSB. That is funny. So they changed, yeah. But this is a classic place. In fact, let's go hit the net because I bet they have a note on this. Yeah. So they translate it master, but they say it can mean to comprehend or overcome it. The verb katalaben is not easy to translate. To seize or to grasp is possible.
There's the grasp.
Yep. But
because that can almost be translated comprehend.
So exactly, and because the word means to grasp or lay hold of something, but it can be used literally to like grab somebody and force master overcome them, or intellectually. Oh, I get that. I grasped that idea.
Yeah. Which even the word to master it. Yeah, if I say I mastered algebra, it says, well, I have an understanding of it that I can use it.
Exactly. Exactly. So we use the same word a couple different ways, and so does the Greek language, is the point. Is it? And you look up the references of where and when it's used, it can be used either way. So I'm curious why they argue for one, though. So it says, but, can you see that? Yeah, that little box. I don't know if I can make that any bigger. I don't know if the box gets any bigger, but, yeah, not really.
That's a little
better. Okay. So, to seize or grasp is possible, but this also permits to grasp with the mind in the sense of to comprehend, especially in the middle voice, which, I gotta look. Was that in the middle voice?
No.
It was in the active. Interesting. Okay, so especially in the middle voice, it means to comprehend. This is probably another Johannine double meaning. I knew they were going to say that. So this is classic in Johannine literature. In other words, studying John. John is notorious for being ambiguous. He'll use subtleties that you can take one or two different ways. And it's like they call it his idiolect. In other words, just the way he likes to talk.
Okay.
Yeah. It's how he thinks. He thinks in kind of abstracts, and he likes to, it's almost like poetry, right? It's like, it's dense language that you can take more than one way. And so that doesn't surprise me. He says, this is, what's that?
Kind of like purposely leaving it more open-ended for, like, think about this.
Exactly. Almost like the book of Proverbs, right? So Proverbs is probably one of the more notorious places where it's poetic language, it's purposefully ambiguous. Like you can take it more than one way, but that's kind of the whole point of the proverb, is you're meant to think about it and you're meant to mull it over and try and think about it from more than one angle. So that's where, in the end, and he'll probably say this, both translations are good.
More application, you know.
Yeah.
Depending on, you know, what's going on in your...
Yeah, the proverbs raise a child in the way they should go and they will not depart from it. It can be a good thing if you're a Christian parent raising them up in the word and they'll come back, or if you're not taking responsibility and you're letting the world raise your child, then they're not going to leave it. So it can be both ways.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. And I think that doesn't surprise me that they're appealing to that. I was going to appeal to it if they didn't, but is, you know, it's, but I kind of think that way too, is like, well, sometimes it's rather than an either or, it's a both and. Like we can think of it from both angles. And it actually is healthy to think, it's like a mental exercise to be like, oh man, they're actually both make sense. So the question is, which one makes more sense in the context? But then if you change the context, I was just going to say, let's go to John 3, but here he's going to do that. So let me just finish reading his note. So he says, this is probably another Johanna and double meaning. One does not usually think of darkness as trying to understand light, for to mean this, darkness must be understood as meaning certain people, or perhaps humanity at large, darkened in understanding. But in John's usage, dark is not normally used of people or a group of people. Rather, it usually signifies the evil environment or sphere in which people find themselves. And he appeals to John 3:19. They love darkness rather than light. Those who follow Jesus do not walk in darkness, John 8:12. They are to walk while they have light, lest the darkness overtake or overcome them, which is the same verb used in John 12, which is, so he's arguing the John 12 context has, it makes a little more sense with the overcoming language, which we'd, you know, have to look that up and see if we agree. But he says, for John, with this set of symbols and imagery, darkness is not something which seeks to understand or comprehend the light, but represents the forces of evil which seek to overcome or conquer it. So the English verb to master may be used in both sorts of contexts, which you just pointed out, which is why they went with that word in their translation, mm-hmm. is you can take it either way.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that, I mean, that's an interesting translation call. But I was just wondering, because like John 3, where Jesus uses similar language. We're way over time. Sorry, guys. Yeah. So we're running down the rabbit hole, aren't we? Having a good time.
That's good, though.
But somewhere in here,
that's probably
when he talks about, yeah, so yeah, just the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. I was just curious. So you guys have to check that out and see what you decide. Typically, that's why it's almost even in our
well,
in our look.
Where it says everyone practicing evil hates the light.
Yeah.
Not only don't get it, but
they hate it.
You oppose it.
Right. Which is interesting. But then he says, he who does the truth comes to light, that his deeds may be clearly seen. So he has this imagery throughout his book. But the question is, yeah, which one is he appealing to more? The idea of mental comprehension or the idea of conquering? Because like he appeals to John 3 or 12:35. Jesus said, a little while longer the light is with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. And most translations, I would suspect, are going to use more of a, 12:35. You guys have nothing better to do, right? I'm sorry. We're over time. Yeah, man, we're having a blast. Yeah, this is great. This is great. Yeah, so almost all of them are saying overtake. They're using the verb overtake in the context of John 12, which is that's why Metzger or whatever is arguing that it's maybe more consistent to translate it that way in John 1. But he still chooses mastered in order to be just ambiguous enough that you can take it either way. Mm-hmm. You know, which
he's being John.
Exactly. He's trying, which I appreciate, like he's trying to be consistent with what we think, yeah, John the author would have been saying. So that's a lot of fun.
Subject, you would almost be afraid to put too much of an ironclad word down.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah, butcher it or take too strong of a firm stand, which is why, like, you have to make a choice in a translation committee. But that's why I like, you know, even if we decide against the New King James, I like how they footnote it and they say it can mean this or that. And probably several translations do that. But I appreciate when they footnote it because then it's like, okay, they leave the options open to the interpreter and you can now grapple through it. Exactly. Exactly.
Especially if you're expecting something there, like I was telling you earlier, and you see that it's not there, to have the footnote.
Yes. Yes.
It redeems the translation.
Right.
Even if I disagree with them taking it out.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And I'm curious, because I haven't worked as much through the CSB as you have or John has. Like, I just haven't spent much time with it. I love the New King James footnote system. Like, I think they're really honest with it. And, like, I'm translating the Old Testament, Joshua, right now. And numerous times I have come across it. I actually prefer the ESV translation in Old Testament narrative a bunch of times. But most of the time, the New King James will still footnote it. Even if it translates it, you know, the other way, you know, it'll still footnote the more literal rendering of it, which I prefer. But the ESV will put that in the text as their preferred translation, as the more literal, you know.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I
so.
Know why that
well, you see,
yeah.
All of their train of thought.
Exactly.
Yeah. Instead of just being told, this is the way it is.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, man, well, we didn't quite finish all of the debates of verses 1 through 5, but so let's we'll wrap it up. I'll close this in prayer, and then we'll be done for tonight. Next week, we're going to come back, try to tackle subjunctives, and then I'll explain it, and then as much as time will allow, we'll get back to practicing translation because, oh yeah, verse 7 has a subjunctive for us. So if we just pick it up in verse 6 and keep going, then we'll get to practice some subjunctives next week, all right? So should we pray quick? Sean, do you want to pray for us?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead. Amen.
Yeah.